Good afternoon, everybody. Going to call to order Senate State Affairs. Today is Tuesday, April 5th, 2022. Let the record reflect the time is 3:39 p.m. We had a little delay on some paperwork here. We have present today Vice Chair Senator Reinhold, Senator Costello, Senator Hall, and myself, Chair Schauer. Senator Kawasaki is going to have his staff brief later in the bill. He won't be available today. Please silence your cell phones. Staff assisting us in the restroom of my committee, we have Carrie with Senate Records, and we have Nate with the LAO. Sorry, standing joke now on this committee for names. We have three bills on the agenda: Senate Bill 188, Criminal Procedure Change of Name from the Governor; Senate Bill 221, Changing RPL Process, Senator Wilikowski; Senate Bill 194, Allowing Electronic Driver's Licenses and IDs, by Senator Kawasaki. First bill we're going to take up is 188, and we're going to have, let's see, actually, who do we have today? Is it just going to be, okay, so we're going to have Mr. Skidmore, Deputy Attorney General from the Department of Law. And when you're ready, if you want to go ahead and provide any comments, John, to get started, and then we'll go through a few other things.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. As the chair indicated, I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Alaska Department of Law Criminal Division. We're here to talk about Senate Bill 188. There are four primary things that Senate Bill 188 does to protect victims. The first is it deals with name changes, requiring that those that are under the control of Department of Corrections or that have to register as a sex offender have to notice to the Department of Corrections and the Department of Public Safety if they intend to change their name. That's predominantly because we have heard in many other contexts and many other forums about victims complaining that defendants were attempting to manipulate the system by changing their name to hide either on the registry or when their status changed in the Department of Corrections. This bill doesn't prohibit them from being able to change their name. It just says that those departments and the victims should receive notice and are able to weigh in with the court, and that the court has some new standards to evaluate whether or not the name of the change of the name is appropriate. There's also some provisions in there about bail that are really trying to address or get at a significant number of defendants who are released pretrial with little or no bail at all. Many are released on OR. That is their own recognizance. And that's fine. But the problem that has been found is that there are a significant number of cases in which individuals violate the bail again and again and again. And what we find is that the courts have not been adjusting bail to reflect those additional violations. And so what the bill proposes to do is to create, not create, to expand a presumption that already exists in the law for other types of offenses. And that presumption just says that the courts are to presume that the individual, the defendant, poses a danger to the community if they are violating conditions that were set already in their case. And that should be a suggestion then to the court that they should be adjusting bail as well. Courts are not required to adjust bail with that presumption, but it certainly would give a strong indication that they should be. The area that I think I would probably focus on most is a rule change that relates to grand juries. It's the idea of being able to use hearsay at grand jury. And this really originated from a 2019 case, State v. Powell, that was the courts indicating that presenting a recorded statement of a victim of a sexual abuse of a minor, that is a child who had given a recorded video statement to police and investigators, that was not admissible at grand jury without the child coming to testify at grand jury as well. And the department's position and the administration's position is that fundamentally goes against the bill that had previously been enacted to allow that very thing to occur. This was a bill that was introduced back in 2005. It actually passed both the Senate and the House unanimously and allowed hearsay to be presented in those circumstances. What the Powell case found, or what it indicated, is that it thought the rule change that law that was enacted meant to address was trials and not grand jury, because one of the requirements it said that it found was that a victim would be subject to cross-examination. And the court found that a victim is never subject to cross-examination at grand jury because the defendant's counsel is never present in that circumstance. It further went on to expressly note, had the legislature intended to allow that type of hearsay at grand jury, they should have amended the court rules to allow that type of information at grand jury. That's precisely what we've come back to do here, is to allow that type of information at grand jury. The reasons for it are twofold. First, it protects victims from being re-traumatized in the system by having to tell one of the most horrific events in their life over and over and over again, such as a child victim. Or in the converse, our bill doesn't simply propose to allow hearsay for those child victims, but actually allows hearsay to be proposed at grand jury in any criminal case. And the reason for that is because while this case originated in 2019, it was shortly thereafter that grand jury proceedings and trial proceedings were shut down because of a global health pandemic. And that created significant backlogs. And as we started trying to look for efficiencies, the department discovered in its research that there are actually 32 other states that allow hearsay to be presented at grand juries. Also, the federal government allows hearsay to be presented at grand juries. Significantly, Ohio, Texas, and Hawaii all have within their state constitutions, just like Alaska, that an individual should be indicted by a grand jury before a felony case can go to trial. And yet all three of those states, Ohio, Texas, and Hawaii, allow hearsay to be presented at grand jury. I would note, ironically enough, that after our Constitution was enacted, we, Alaska, allowed hearsay at grand juries. State v. Parks, a case from 1968, and Buckholder v. State, a case from 1971, both found that a grand jury proceeding based exclusively on hearsay was appropriate and admissible. It was only in 1973 that the Alaska Supreme Court adopted a rule to change that and prohibit certain types of hearsay from being admissible. So this isn't a question of whether or not it's constitutional. Our Supreme Court already found that it was. This is about a rule change, and it's a rule change that we are asking this committee to accept within this bill, to support that and to pass it on to the next committee. Those are really my comments in sum. I understand there was a previous hearing in this bill already and that the committee may have some questions for me. So I will allow the committee to ask any questions it may have so that I can help you understand the bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. We're going to go ahead and open up to committee members for questions. Okay. None being at this time. We also have some other, quite a few actually, that are here on this one. Lisa Perrington online for questions. We also have Renee McFarland, AK Public Defenders, for questions as well. So we have a number of folks, including some public testimony a little bit later. We have the courts and Department of Public Safety, et cetera, here. So is there anybody else that would like to come up and provide any further comments from a governmental perspective? They're welcome to come on up. I know there were some costs and other issues as well. So Ms. Nancy Mead from the courts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. And I would I very much appreciate this chance to put some concerns that the court system has on the record with respect to this bill. There are a couple of things that I believe are somewhat problematic in this bill, and I think I'll mostly address just two areas right now. The first is with respect to Section 6 of the bill, and Mr. Skidmore did mention that it would be more efficient to have certain findings made by the court during bail orders to be need to be written. I want to say that I included some documents for the committee's consideration. What I would like to say about Section 6 is that the court system thinks it is extremely problematic to try to implement that section. This would require that every bail order have written findings for each thing that is ordered in a bail order. I included in some documents that I provided through the committee chair's office the number of bail orders that are issued each year, as well as the total number of bail hearings, and I also provided a sample bail order so the committee could get an idea of the sorts of things that are ordered. So first, the one document shows that the number of bail orders issued in a typical year range from, you know, 20,000, 25,000, 19,000, et cetera. So that's the number of orders that would be impacted by this provision that would need to have written reasons for each of the findings. Similarly, I have a count of bail hearings that occurred in the last several years, and that's around the 20,000 mark also. So what this would require, Section 6 of that bill, is to take each of those orders that comes out of those, 20,000 a year, and I gave you a sample one, a sample blank bail order, and you can see that there are dozens of things that the court can order. The court typically now checks a box, and the way it works is that when somebody is arrested and goes through an arraignment, it is almost always the prosecutor who seeks to have conditions imposed on this person if they're going to be released. As you can imagine, based on the philosophy of the agencies, the district attorney, the prosecutor, usually wants more conditions, a higher bail amount. Well, the public defender, in turn, representing his or her client's best interests, will typically want fewer restrictions on the person. And so the sort of, it's ironic to me that this bill would require the court to make a written finding for everything ordered when it's really the prosecutor who's asking for most of these things to be ordered. And you can see if you thumb through this order and conditions of release that should be in your packet, the range of things that can be ordered. And I would submit that most of these, if the box is checked, it's very obvious what the reason is. For example, if there's a domestic violence condition that says the defendant shall not return to the residence of blank, which is typically the victim's name, it's fairly obvious why that would be ordered in any bail order, because that's the danger that this person presents to the person. So it appears to me that it may be unnecessary, first of all, but secondly, it would pretty much cripple the court system. We do, as I say, 20,000 of these in a typical afternoon. The judges rotate who has the arraignment calendar. They start at 1 o'clock in Anchorage, and they try to finish by 4:30, so they don't have to pay overtime. Sometimes it goes over. So to have to write a reason for each one of the things ordered would be very, very difficult for the court to comply with. And I will say that, as I mentioned to the chair's office, I did not submit a fiscal note on this bill yet, because if I had to do a fiscal note on that aspect of the bill, it would be it would really be shocking, I'm afraid, because we would need new judges, new clerks to handle the added burden that would add. So that's our problem I wanted the committee to be aware of with respect to Section 6. The next section that I'll, or really the second thing that I'll talk about, are the court rule changes. I also included in your packet a list of the Criminal Rules Committee members. The reason I included that is because there are 4 to 5 pages of this bill that would be changes to the criminal rules. I left my criminal rules book at my seat, but it looks like a phone book, and there are rules that of procedure that let the attorneys or self-represented persons know how to get the substantive rights that the legislature gives them. And they range from things like how many days you have to answer a complaint, all the way up to all those evidence rules on hearsay, et cetera. The Criminal Rules Committee is active. It meets 4 to 5 times a year. It has basically 4 defense attorneys, 4 people with a prosecutorial mindset, including 2 from the Department of Law. One is the city prosecutor for the Muni, and one is the head of the Office of Victims' Rights, and it has 4 judges. They are experts in criminal procedures. It's somewhat of an honor to be appointed by the Supreme Court to one of these committees. They field recommendations from anybody about a proposed rule change, just like you might field you know, recommendations from constituents on a statutory change. And these folks are able to talk it through on a level that I can't understand typically, because again, they're very well versed. And so the question whether the hearsay rule should be changed as proposed in this bill, and secondly, the very sort of technical changes in the next sections to the rules, sections 15 and 16, that redefine plain error and harmless error and tactical decision. I mean, this is hard for me to understand. It seems to me that a forum for analyzing whether this is a good procedure exists, and it may be more appropriate to allow that group who is comprised for that very reason to handle the proposed rule changes rather than have the legislature do it, because these deserve a lot of attention. If you look at the hearsay rule in the rules of court, it takes up 15 pages of small print with all the case annotations, and that is something that the committee could review and discuss and spar back and forth between both sides with the judges. And the same for the plain error rule, which is section 15 and 16. That has a lot of permutations. And I think I counted 100 to 120 case annotations that discuss the plain error rule. It's a deep and technical area of law, and it's a procedural area of law. So I don't have a view as to whether those are a good or bad idea or constitutional or not, but I will say that it deserves a lot of attention. I also included for you two Supreme Court cases. One is fairly old and one is from 2018. Those cases speak to the substance of the hearsay rule and whether it should be allowed in grand jury. And as Mr. Skidmore said, well, Mr. Skidmore thought it was not a constitutional issue. Those cases, one of them, the Wasilli case, goes through pages and pages and pages analyzing the Constitutional Convention minutes and why the grand jury rule is important. It is in the Constitution. It's considered a protection so that innocent people won't be brought up to trial. There is a lot of discussion in that case, and I really want to say that mostly that's there to illustrate to you the complexity of the issue and how it is something that needs to be explored in tremendous detail, most likely by people who work with the rule every day. So I would submit that perhaps this could be resolved in another way. I also checked in these rules. Proposals or changes were never submitted to the Criminal Rules Committee. As I say, we have a full-time court rules attorney whose job it is to work with these committees, put things into the appropriate format, and present once a month to the Supreme Court about recommendations or thoughts on rule changes. That didn't happen with these, but it could. And so with that, I think I will just, you know, I'd welcome questions. But those are some of the concerns that I've seen with this bill.
Quick question, Nancy. Thanks for that. I always like to get both sides because you never know what you're going to hear. For the Criminal Rules Committee to work with the administration, if that was how would that play out? What would the process for that be?
To the chair, we actually have a rule on rulemaking. It's Administrative Rule 44, I believe. Anyone can write an email, a note, a phone call, typically does it to our court rules attorney, and say, hey, this rule should be changed, and I can discuss it. I can give you a draft so you can put it in the appropriate format. The Department of Law has two members on the Criminal Rules Committee. They can bring up a proposal for a rule change orally at any of the meetings. And our court rules attorney will say, okay, let me open a file, let me draft it up, and then we'll discuss it at the next few meetings or what have you. And so it is can be very simple to bring a proposal to one of those committees.
Last question, I'll go, because I know other committee members have them here. Is that something that would require legislative input or change, or is that something that can happen outside of this process? In other words, could they just propose that rule, agree to it, and then that can be changed?
To the chair, yes. The rules of court are adopted by the Supreme Court without the legislature, because they're procedural rather than substantive. So that exists sort of parallel to the legislature. It's the courts, almost like what you might think of as regulations for agencies. And so there.
Perfect. Thank you. And I saw Senator Holland pull up his mic first, so I'll let him have the first hack at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I see Wisely versus State. I don't see the other one. Could you just give me the reference on the other case?
It's called Giefels. I don't know how to pronounce it. G-I-E-F-F-E-L-S.
Okay.
And I can provide you another copy if you don't have it in your packet. That's the 1976 case, so it's a little bit older. But it speaks to the protections that the grand jury gives. And it also says that it's adopting the ABA, the Bar Association standards for how prosecutors present cases for grand juries, which basically is our rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And these are available for everybody. We just didn't print everything out just because it was going to kill a bunch more trees. So didn't think we needed them for everybody today. Senator, I think it was Senator Rambold is next.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I really find it to be amazing on page 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13, I think it talks about different court rule changes. So it's extensive. I've never seen a bill like this before. So first of all, I'm going to say where my prejudice is, I guess, is anything to get sexual assault cases prosecuted more quickly and more of these perpetrators in Alaska behind bars is where my preference is. Okay, so I think you know that. But this is a lot. I mean, when you go over the fact that it changes plain error, it changes Rule 12, it changes Rule 84, it addresses Rule 6R 47B 12, which I've normally only seen like one rule in a bill. So this is a lot. So if you could just step back and just go over the committee at the court, what you guys do and the procedure there. And I think you said there's two people on the administration that's on that. If you could just enlighten us, that would be helpful for me. Thank you.
Sure. Through the chair to Senator Rambold, I first want to say that under the Constitution, the legislature does have the right to change court rules with a two-thirds majority. And that happens. Up until very recently, that has always happened, almost always, because the legislature changes a substantive law, which obviously you do through a bill, and incidentally, it has the effect of changing a court rule, a procedure that is correlated with that substantive law. And so you often see in a bill at the bottom an indirect court rule change. It happens to impact this, or even a direct rule change. And that is needs to be passed by the two-thirds majority, and typically is. It is unusual to have a bill that just directly affects and changes rules. Again, I want to be clear that it is permitted by the Constitution, but it is unusual to have that sort of a change by the legislature of a court rule. So the way to answer your question, Senator Rambold, is that there are rules committees, and they are comprised of people appointed by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court tries to get kind of a well-rounded group of people to discuss whether proposals for a rule change should be adopted, should they be changed a little bit, and what should be recommended to the Supreme Court to ultimately be adopted as a procedural rule. For example, I think I included for you the members of the Criminal Rules Committee, and you can see a prosecutor might propose to the rest of his or her committee members that we do this with the hearsay rule, that, and they'll talk it out and they'll come up with a recommendation to the Supreme Court. And again, our court rules attorney, one of our attorneys on staff, goes and meets with the Supreme Court monthly to say, here's a recommendation that came from the Criminal Rules Committee. Here's one that came from the Child in Need of Aid Rules Committee. Here's something the Criminal Rules Committee discussed and decided not to recommend the court do, but wanted to present to you, the court, some minority views on whether it should be adopted or what have you. So the Supreme Court then has the chance to adopt rule changes after they go through this process. As I mentioned, there are, I think, 9 rules committees, and they're typically made up of experts in the area, say the Appellate Rules Committee, are lawyers that appear in front of the appellate courts and have noted some procedural improvement that could be made to the rule. So I hope that answers your question about the rule changes.
Follow-up?
Okay, so I think I understand all that pretty well, but my question was, are there people in regards to the administration that already can do this? And to me, this looks almost like our Rules Committee in both the House and the Senate, and also Mason's Rules of Procedure that we go by. It almost seems like that court rule book. Is that a fair description?
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, the rules committees do not follow formal rules, either Roberts or Mason's. They meet in a conference room, the 12 people on this list, and as I say, the public defender, the couple of prosecutors, and they discuss things in a less formal way than the legislature would. It is more of a back and forth conversation sitting around a large conference table.
Okay, so one more time.
Follow up.
I'm sorry, I'm going to stop me communicating as clearly as I want to today. So one question is the administration, yes, has the ability to do this. And number two, what I was saying, I wasn't asking if you guys use Roberts or Masons. What I was saying is we as a legislature use Masons, which almost seems like the same as the procedures of court is similar, but how we run our procedures here. I said, would that be a fair comparison? And the second question is, it sounds like, yes, the administration has two appointees to the committee. And I'm sorry, I hadn't had a time to glance at that yet. We got a lot of stuff to look at right now. So,
yes, through the chair to Senator Reinbold, there are two members, employees of the Department of Law on the committee. And in addition, there is the victim's advocate on the committee. I beg your pardon, but you said, can the administration do this? And I'm still not clear on what that question meant, Senator.
I think you just answered it.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think, just to be clear, I think what Senator Ramble is asking is they have the ability to propose these changes in that committee and do those things. Yeah. And that is, yes, they
through
do.
Through the chair, yes.
Not unilaterally, they just have to do it through the committee. They could make those arguments, the back and forth, et cetera. Okay, so that's, I think we got
chair,
that.
Correct.
Did you get your second question? Just to make sure.
And I guess the second one really doesn't matter. It's just I was just comparing the court rules to the legislative procedures that we have to follow on Masons. I know it's totally separate. I know you guys don't use Roberts. I know that, but that was just a parallel for two different branches of government, and that's all I was trying to point out. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions from committee members? Before you go, Nancy, I would like to see. I know that it's a rather shocking one. I think it was the word that you used, but I would like to see that fiscal note if we could before we move it, just because I think that's going to be important as far as what happens here. So if it's something that is possible for you to do, can you get that?
To the chair, can I give you a ballpark?
Absolutely.
I can give it to you right now.
Okay.
I'm estimating that we would need new judges in each of the major courts. A new judge costs about $700,000 when you count the law clerks and the staff that goes with a judge. In addition, we don't have the physical courtrooms for additional judges, so there would be capital expense. But if you consider that there might be 10 new judges, you can do that horrible math and come up with the fact that it would be in the $7 to $10 million range. So you can see why I did not want to submit a fiscal note at this point yet.
Okay, but it's on the record, and that's important because I want to make sure that we're talking about this here. And so you're looking at seven, but then obviously you would have perhaps a more of a one-time capital cost for upgrading facilities, but you would have a recurring cost of, roughly $7 million a year for the judges, clerks, et cetera, that would do the job, correct?
To the chair, yes.
Estimated. Okay. We'll talk to committee members and see if they want something more formal, but at least we have it on the record. That's important. That's okay. So I appreciate your time coming up. Nancy, thank you. And we do have a few others, and because this is one of the deeper, bigger bills and what it touches, we have Lisa Purinton online, and I'm just going to ask you, there's no questions directly for you, Lisa, but do you have any comments on this one today?
To the chair, Lisa Purinton, Alaska Department of Public Safety. Chair Showers, thanks for the question. I don't have anything to add at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. And then we also have Renee McFarland's back with us from the Alaska Public Defenders. If you'd like to make any comments or input at this time, go ahead, Renee.
For the record, Renee McFarland with the Public Defender Agency. We are only available for questions, and so I have no comments at this time.
Okay, that's fine. Just wanted to make sure we had it covered. Thank you. And is there anybody else in the room at this time from more of an invited or government perspective that would like to add to it? Okay. And John, we'll get back to you in a minute for closing comments here. We're just going to go and get our public testimony out of the way. We do have some folks online notice today. So this time we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony on Senate Bill 188. And do we have anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing and hearing none, we do have several people online, and we're just going to go down the order. We have Christine Hutchinson. Christine, if you could, I believe you've been on before. If you go ahead and put yourself on the record with name, who you represent, your location, and I'm going to ask you to try to limit it to 3 minutes today if you could, and go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Showers, for this opportunity to testify, and thank you, committee, for bringing up the opportunity to talk about grand jury. My name is Christine Hutchinson. I live in Kenai, Alaska, where David Haig lives, if that name rings a bell with any of you. Again, you've brought up the subject of grand juries, and I'd like to point out to you one of the primary functions of the grand jury is to provide for the citizenry, for we the people, an opportunity to get some redress from government officials. Now, it has been the practice of the grand jury, of the district attorney, and the gentleman there on the screen, his first name is John, I can't remember his last name, he is familiar with the efforts to prevent the grand jury from hearing certain things they need to hear in helping citizens defend themselves from the bureaucracy. Now, making hearsay legally part of the testimony will not change the fact that the grand jury is being prohibited from one of its original intents, to protect we the people, the citizens, from corrupt elected and appointed officials. Making hearsay evidence part of the testimony before the grand jury and saving emotional pain for the victim does nothing to restore the failure of grand juries to protect the rights of citizens in the first place. Making hearsay part of the testimony and increasing efficiencies by saving money and time, again, does nothing to restore the pain and suffering of the people when they have no recourse against the corruption of elected and appointed officials. Now, you need to be reminded and recall that the function of grand juries is to protect the people. That was their original and their constitutional intent. I hear from the other testimony that whoever brought this bill, the governor, the district attorney, whomever, they got a little over their skis because this should have gone to the Rules Committee, just as Nancy Mead pointed out. This should have been discussed by those people doing criminal rules. We're a little bit ahead of ourselves here, I think, and I'm opposed to this bill going forward. Scrap the hearsay part of the testimony, scrap that all, and create a grand jury that does the function that they were originally intended to do, protect the people. That's all I have to say, and my minutes are winding down on my timer. But again, I would ask you to oppose this bill and send it back to whatever trash can it came from, because it's got all kinds of bad news. Thank you very much for your time. And you guys have a great afternoon.
All right. Thank you very much, Christine, for calling in. And, yeah, you did hit your 3 minutes right on the button, so appreciate that. We're going to go next to Queen Parker from Sterling. Queen, if you can hear me, go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name, who you represent, location, and 3 minutes of testimony. Please begin.
Okay. My name's Queen A. Parker, and I live in Sterling, and I'm representing myself. I just wanted to say that I oppose this SB 1882. The law must apply equally to all people, and the evidence of crime and corruption must be seen and investigated by an independent Alaskan grand jury, and if those in authority will be held accountable. The Alaska grand jury right was formed in 2018 to demand recognition of the rights of all Alaskans to report crime to the grand jury, and the right of the grand jury to investigate such crime as guaranteed by the Alaska Constitution under Article 1, Section 8. And AS 1240 030 is a duty of inquiry into crimes and general powers. AS 12.40.040, the jury to disclose knowledge of crime. AS 11.56.590 is jury tampering. And the Alaska Constitutional Convention
page transcript 1307 to 1409, the power of grand juries to inquire into the willful misconduct in office of public officers and to find indictments in connection therewith shall never be suspended. The grand jury is preserved for all purposes, particularly for investigation of public officials. The grand jury can be appealed to directly, which is an invaluable right to the citizen. And also the Alaska Grand Jury Handbook, page 16. Can a grand juror ask a grand jury to investigate a crime that the district attorney has not presented to them? Yes. The Alaska statute states if an individual grand juror knows or has reason to believe that a crime has been committed that is triable by the court, the juror shall disclose it to the other jurors who shall investigate it. And so we want justice. And I hope to God that the representatives that are in authority will represent us in that situation, in these situations. And so I just thank you for your time. Have a nice day, just like my friend said. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Green, for calling in today and taking the time to testify. We're going to go next to Michael Garvey from the ACLU. Michael, if you can hear me, I know you've been here before. You know how it works. Go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name, who you represent, location, and 3 minutes, please.
Thank you, Chair Schauer and members of the committee. For the record, I am Michael Garvey, Advocacy Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska, calling in from Anchorage. We have serious concerns with how Senate Bill 188 would erode due process rights of criminal defendants and those erroneously convicted of crimes. Specifically, Sections 15 and 16 would dramatically impede the ability to address errors made during the trial process. Together, these sections would change Alaska's criminal appeal system to value finality of convictions over the fairness of those convictions. Fairness is a cornerstone of due process, especially for defendants who are not backed by the power of the state, may not possess the resources for fighting unjust convictions. It's already difficult to reverse convictions because of errors during trials, and we should not be making it more so. Section 14 would vastly increase the amount of hearsay allowed at grand juries. Alaska currently doesn't allow, for instance, police to provide a summary of information they have allegedly heard from various sources. Alaska does provide for some exceptions to this rule, including for child witnesses, as discussed. Senate Bill 188, however, is no narrow remedy. It would fundamentally change the state's approach to hearsay in all kinds of cases and undercut a grand jury's ability to ask questions and assess the truthfulness of that testimony. Defendants already do not possess the right to present evidence to a grand jury, and this change would further stack the deck against them and allow cases to advance on questionable evidence. These provisions, along with language that would reduce the number of unconvicted people released on bail before trial, would erode due process rights. Supporting victims does not have to come at the cost of these critical rights. Alaskans value fairness. Giving prosecutors more tools to put people in prison unjustly and undercut defendants' ability to maintain their innocence does not represent this value. And for these reasons, we oppose Senate Bill 188. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Michael, for calling in and making it 2 minutes. Appreciate that. We're going to move on to Joan Kaur from Soldotna. Joan, if you can put yourself on the record, name who you represent, location, and please 3 minutes or less.
Yes, I'm from Soldotna. I'm Joan Kaur. And Soldotna, Alaska. And I just wanted to say that when I first heard about this bill, I was shocked that they would admit hearsay for evidence. I just thought that was a travesty because it's happened to I could probably find out many examples where this has been used against innocent people. And to make an example of them, anyway, I think it's is not in the best interest of justice. And I agree with that one caller that said to eliminate all references to grand jury out of this bill. I think it's like I said before, a travesty. And I want the rights of the grand jury restored instead of being told what they can and cannot do. So anyway, that's my part on that is. So I thank you for listening and for giving me the opportunity to testify about this.
All right, Joan, thanks for calling in today. Appreciate you taking time. It's nice when citizens get involved. We're going to move next on the list. Mike Coons from Palmer. Mike, you know the drill. Name, who you represent, location, and 3 minutes or less, please.
Yeah, this is Mike Coons, and I want to thank Senator Reinbold for the last questions that she was bringing up, because the answer I was hearing is probably one of the fundamental aspects that I have a real problem with our justice system today, and that is we got a bunch of lawyers that can change the rules where it's supposed to be the legislature that changes the rules through legislation and through bills. So it sounds like to me, in listening to that convoluted response that Senator Reinbold got back, was that this is nothing more than what the speaker was talking about. It sounds like it's nothing more than an extension of what we have right now with the legislative council, who doesn't give a hoot and a holler about what we the people say. It's only what the lawyers say. So if that is part and parcel of this bill, even as much as I do not agree with the ACLU on most anything, I would lean more towards a no on this, because the legislature needs to be making the rules, not a bunch of lawyers telling the Supreme Court what they want to do and the Supreme Court coming up with something without even a lawsuit going on to there. So it's kind of a convoluted mess, and anytime I see a convoluted mess, I'm against it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike, for calling in today. We have our last one today is Charles McKee from Anchorage. Charles, if you can hear me, put yourself on the record. Name, who you represent, location, and please begin.
Thank you. I've already faxed in the application for a permanent fund, which is on the bottom of that is the notary witness of my signature, so that indicates who I am and my lack of confidence in the legislative body, the voting aspect of our esteemed corporate court / bar association controlled corporate state. And then I faxed this article pertaining to federal Senate looking into prison systems in the lower 48, and the writing on the alongside of that for me, dated 3/6/2022, 1:49 p.m. CM is my signature there. And then the article on February the 9th outlined an indication that there was no citation for the reason why I was arrested and booked in Palmer Jail. Then when I told the judge in chains that I had a hearing to go to, workers' comp, he released me on my own OR so I could go to that hearing 2 days after the fact. So I was released and went to the hearing, and it discussed the fact that the $113,000 that was rerouted out of my Social Security account didn't end up in my pocket, which resulted in me being evicted from the yard I lived in for 11 years with 5 pit bulls, which brought me into the situation in Anchorage and in Palmer. So there was no state statute, no citation for my arrest, although I was arrested. And then I caught the court in 2019, September, of falsifying the court records after the fact. I wrote my own affidavit and had it witnessed by officer of the court that was there. And so the clerk of court, the judge, Nesbitt, the prosecutor, haven't been brought to justice, which is a 2-year mandatory federal prison sentence, and to the exclusion of ever holding office again. That's federal and state law. That's policy. So that has, and I turned that into the Attorney General's Office, U.S., and they kind of restrained, and then I turned the case into the Attorney General's Office, Arlington, Virginia, against RICO charges, restraint of trade, and civil rights against the very person that advocated this bill, which is the request of the governor, which I might point out to you, I testified against another bill April 26, 2019, fish tax bill that was requested by the governor, and I went before Bert Stedman, and I exposed the Sustecate Trust program, which is based off of bankruptcy, and we've been in bankruptcy since 1933.
Charles, if you could do me a favor, if you could try to wrap it up. We're coming up on 4 minutes.
Thank you very much. I went into court saying to the judge that I'm the beneficiary of the McKee Trust. You, sir, are my trustee, the clerk of court, and all that was wiped out in the record. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Charles, for calling in today to testify. And I don't see anyone else online, so it looks like that's it. So we're going to go ahead and close public testimony on Senate Bill 188. All right. So at this point, I'm just going to allow committee members if they have any comments or questions at the end here before I let Mr. Skidmore just some closing comments for the day. So, Mr. Skidmore, we'll turn it back over to you. And it looks like we've gone through all the comments. If you have any closing ones for today, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. The things that I would say, first to address some of the comments from the court system, I'm not going to get into the written findings on bail hearing. I'm not going to take issue with what they think any fiscal notes may be. I actually did not talk about written findings. I had only talked about the presumption in a bail hearing. I appreciate what they have said and understand the cost that that may represent, and I think that's a policy decision for the committee to make, whether that's the type of thing that's appropriate or not. What I did, however, want to address is that what the two cases that Ms. Mead cited, Geffels and Wassily, those two cases, I think, are illustrative of exactly why the rules should be changed. The Geffels case was handed down in 1976, 3 years after the Supreme Court changed the rules to say that hearsay wouldn't be admissible. And I agree that Geffels walks through and provides a lot of information about what happens in those cases. But Geffels, for example, was a case that said the indictment had to be dismissed because the state had presented hearsay at the time of doctors who were out of state and couldn't be there in person. And it was after the Geffels case was handed down that the rules were changed to allow telephonic testimony so that that wouldn't continue to be a problem, particularly in a state our size. And so I think Geffels is illustrative of when the courts hand down certain rulings that it is appropriate for the legislature to step in and to fix policy issues. I agree with Ms. Mead that there is a committee that can meet to look at rules. However, the notion that that committee would overrule something that the courts had already handed down as case law, I don't think that's something that very commonly happens. And if it were to happen, they only meet 3 or 4 times a year. It takes them an extremely long time to review rules and to be talking about them. The legislature is a more efficient process. The bill that originally allowed the hearsay began in the legislature, and the court case Powell that said you can't actually do what the legislature was trying to do expressly stated that the legislature should change these other court rules if that's what it wanted attempted to do. And so that's why we're here back in front of the legislature to say the Powell case from the court system says if you all want to accomplish this, you all should change the rules, as Ms. Mead indicated was appropriate to do. The Wassily case is interesting because it does talk about the importance of the constitutional right to a grand jury, and the administration is not in any way taking an issue with that. In fact, we agree that the grand jury plays a very important role, and we want the grand jury to continue to play that role. We just want them to be able to do it in a more logical, common sense manner a manner that is consistent with what 32 other states and the federal government does by allowing hearsay at grand jury. It doesn't eliminate grand jury. It just talks about the evidence that they can and should be able to consider. Our grand jury already considers a significant number of types of hearsay, but it still presents challenges and problems that could be easily remedied by what this bill proposes. And I would note that WASLI, what it stands for, is that an individual who was an escape in the second degree walked away from a halfway house. What happened at grand jury is they admitted the report of what had happened with that walkaway. Case moves on to trial. A trial jury hears all the evidence, hears all the witnesses that were mentioned in that report. They come and testify. They're subject to cross-examination. And after fully considering all of the evidence in the case, the jury convicts Mr. Wasilla. And then the Court of Appeals says, or actually, excuse me, it may not have been the Court of Appeals, it may have been the Supreme Court, said, no, that case now needs to be overturned. What the jury found isn't sufficient because there was a problem at grand jury where a report was introduced that violated a court rule that you shouldn't admit hearsay at that stage. And it's that type of inefficiency that we're trying to address in these circumstances. Waiting until after the conviction to then say, wait a minute, grand jury wasn't done properly, isn't an appropriate way for the system to be efficient and functional. In that circumstance, if that had been a sexual assault case, we are saying that victim must now go back to grand jury and testify again, and then must go through a cross-examination in the trial again. Why? Simply because the first grand jury relied on a report, even though everything else was error-free. That's what we're talking about in this case. And so I think WASLI is an excellent example to help illustrate that point. And while I appreciate Senator Reinbold's concerns about the number of pages in the bill that address the rules, I would simply like to point out that all of page 9 is trying to delete language to simplify one rule, Criminal Rule 6, that addresses grand jury. Instead of having all of these different criteria of when hearsay can or can't be admitted, it's a very simple statement. It takes a page of text and reduces it to 1.5 lines of text that says grand jury can hear and rely on hearsay testimony. The other pages are all about the plain error rule. And I understand the concerns that are expressed about the plain error rule. I would note that the WASLI case also overturned that grand jury, overturned that conviction based on a concept in the plain error. It relied on the Adams case that changed how plain error was interpreted in our state. And all that we attempted to do was to rely on the case law that existed prior to Adams and put that back in place in the rules. I, however, would acknowledge, I believe the plain error rule is a more complicated rule to try and navigate through. And I understand if that particular rule is one that this committee is more comfortable leaving to the lawyers to sort out. But grand jury is not something that is complicated. It's not something that requires the lawyers to sort out. It is a simple, common sense solution to make things better for victims and to make the system work more efficiently. We're not doing away with grand jury. We're not doing away with the ability for defense counsel to argue that grand jury is improper, that there was insufficient evidence, that there was an incorrect instruction provided to the grand jury, that the evidence that was admitted, even if through hearsay, was collected in a manner that violated the Fourth or the Fifth Amendments for search and seizure or how a statement is taken. There is nothing that prohibits defense from arguing that the hearsay that is offered is inaccurate in terms of what the reports actually said or what those witnesses said. There are multiple ways in which the evidence is still reviewed and can be contested by the defendants. So in sum, while I appreciate and hear the concerns that people have about protecting grand jury, I would submit to the committee, this bill doesn't say that grand jury isn't still a protection for the people. All of the benefits, all of the protections that people are interested in, I would submit to you all, are still present. There's just a different way to be able to present the evidence. Instead of making that victim of a vehicle theft have to take time off of work and come in to grand jury for 5 minutes to say, yes, I own that vehicle, no, that person didn't have a right to the vehicle. If they've already told that to the officer ought to simply be able to convey that to the grand jury so the case can go to trial. And at trial, that owner will have to come in. Well, why do you inconvenience them time and time again? People complain about the criminal justice system and how it re-traumatizes them and how it's broken. This is an effort to try and fix it in a way similar to what the vast majority of states in our country already use. So those are the reasons that I would submit that you all should be supporting the bill. And I appreciate the concerns that the people down on the Kenai Peninsula are expressing. This bill is in no way touching those issues. Those are issues that have to be addressed elsewhere and will be addressed elsewhere. But this isn't the right forum for that, and that's not what this bill is about. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. So I think we've got a couple of questions here, Senator Rambold.
So in regards to the very last thing he said about Kenai, one, I just want you to answer two questions. Is the grand jury there to protect the people? And number two, can you give a concise update on what is going on with the grand jury in Kenai? Because we're getting an awful lot of emails about that.
Yes, I believe that grand juries are there to protect the people. The challenge, I know you asked for a concise answer, Senator Rheingold, but the challenge for that is that the protection of the people that's generally talked about is to ensure that the evidence presented should warrant an indictment, should mean that that case goes forward to trial. The type of issue that the folks on the Kenai Peninsula are concerned about is that there is some sort of corruption within the system that largely is based upon a single case that has been in litigation for 18 years. And the offender in that case wants to continue to try and litigate the case. I'm not going to talk more about it here other than to say we are aware of the concerns. It is something that's being actively looked at and worked on. And I hope that that will be addressed soon. But beyond that, I'm not at liberty to talk about ongoing litigation.
Senator Holland, anything? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Skidmore, for calling in. Obviously, there's some contentious issues with the spills. We'll continue to address those with other committee members. I think there's some good things to chew on here, including the cost of it, as like you said, a policy call. So we're going to go ahead at this time and set this bill aside. We'll bring it back up at a future date, and I appreciate everybody from all the various agencies coming in on this one because this was actually a little more in detail than I thought we might get today, so I appreciate the time. And we're going to move on to the next bill today. It's going to be Senate Bill 221, Changing the RPL Process by Senator Wilikowski. And we've got both Senator and his staff to come up to brief us on this one. This is going to be the first hearing of the bill. When you're ready, you guys can put yourself on the record. And before we get to the committee substitute, we're just going to have you address the Senate bill itself first, and then we'll get to the substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator, representing East Anchorage and J-Bear, and joined by Sonia Kawasaki, Chief of Staff for my office. I appreciate you hearing this bill, this which seeks to fix the way appropriations are dealt with when the legislature is not in session. Under the Constitution, Article 9, Section 13, the legislature is the appropriating body. That's very clear. But in practice, there is a statute called the Revised Program Legislative that creates a process that allows the executive branch to decide when, where, how much to appropriate funds received when the legislature is not in session. How is that possible for the governor to appropriate funds when the Constitution very clearly says that appropriations must be done by the legislature? I would suggest that it is not possible and that the law is unconstitutional. There was a lawsuit on this issue last year. It went to the Superior Court. However, the legislature reconvened before there was an opportunity for the court to decide on that particular issue. Even assuming it is constitutional, the question I would pose is this really the process that we want to give one individual the sole authority to decide where hundreds of millions of dollars, or perhaps over $1 billion, as we saw recently, where all that money goes with little or no public process and very little legislative oversight. This bill seeks to fix that process, to restore the legislature's constitutional role in the budgeting process, and to streamline it so we can deal with the situation where we do have unexpected revenue. This bill is about protecting our budgeting process, restoring balance between the legislature and the executive branch, and about giving the public more of a say in how our state money is spent. I have my staff here to go through the details of the bill, Mr. Chairman, but happy to answer any general questions at this point.
Thanks, Senator Rulikowski. What we're going to do here is we're going to go ahead and I wanted to get the initial online and the things that have changed here, or I should say on the record. So we have a new working draft that has come out in the meantime. So what I would like to do is we're going to go ahead and I'll ask the committee members if they have any questions, but we're going to take a stop here and go through and get the CS adopted, assuming we have no objections to that. So we can discuss that, and then we'll be working on the appropriate document. So it, just before that happens, does anybody have a comment or question for the senator? Go ahead. Senator Ramble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for bringing this up. I have been so upset about the RPL process. I'm on Ledge Budget and Audit, and it has caused tremendous contention the last three, now going on 4 years. And so I just, it was over $1.25 billion. And I remember I was sitting through all those meetings, and it, even during session, you know, when we were back in Anchorage, I was trying to attend all the LBA meetings. So I'm not going to go into details right now, but I just am so thankful that you're bringing this forth.
Anyone else? Okay, so what we're going to do now is, like I said here, we have a new version of the bill, so we're going to go ahead and go for that at this point. Senator Reinbold, can we have a motion to take up the CS for Senate Bill 221, version I, as the working draft, please?
Chair Schauer, I move the committee substitute for SB 221, Work Order 32LS1472-I, the RPL process offered by Senator Walikowski.
All right.
As a working document.
Thank you. And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Does anybody have any comments? Senator Costello?
Thank you. I just wanted to ask the sponsor, when I look at the committee substitute, it appears to me that this would generate a title change because it goes into the a different statute, AS 2405-100, related to special sessions. And I see it just adds, you know, a new letter E on line two. But could you respond to that?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Costello, it may require a title change. What happened was we were pushing up against the filing deadline, and we had waited several weeks, and I know legislative legal was just swamped, and unfortunately the version they got, we couldn't review the version that we got, so we had to file it before the bill filing deadline, and then when we got it, we said we recognized that there were some changes that needed to be made. So thank you for pointing that out, but that's absolutely something we could do. And if it's within this body, it only requires a majority vote. So thank you for pointing that out.
Go ahead. Yeah, Senator Costello, follow-up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, based on that response and my reading of it, I think I'd prefer we go for a title change just so that everything that's in the bill is reflected in the title.
Would you like to make that?
Not now.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Happy to do that, and I'd rather get it right here while we can. So other comments or questions before I remove my objection to make this the working document? Okay, seeing and hearing none, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to using version I as the working document. And at this point, hearing no other comments on it or objections, version I has been adopted as a working document. So we can go ahead and talk about the CS now. So if we want to take that up, we can. And just as an advisement, we are going to take public testimony today as well. We'll hold on for that. So questions or comments from committee members before we go to the next version and get the rest of the briefing? Okay, seeing and hearing none, we'll start off. If Senator Wilikowski, do you have any comments, or just go right to staff on version I?
Right to staff, Mr. Chair.
Okay, sounds good. Sonia, when you're ready, put yourself on the record and take us through it, please.
Thank you, Chair Schauer and the members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. For the record, I'm Sonia Kawasaki, staff to Senator Bill Wilikowski. Mr. Chair, SB 221 provides reforms to the statutory revised program legislative process to fix defects with it that arguably render it unconstitutional. The current RPL process under AS 3707080H essentially assigns the government the power of appropriations over certain additional funds, such as federal funds, that the state may acquire when the legislature is not available to address expenditures. Under the current process, if the state receives federal dollars when the legislature is not meeting, the governor is presumably authorized to spend funds that the full legislature did not appropriate. The Alaska Constitution grants the power of appropriations to the legislature, and the legislature has both the power and the duty of appropriations and cannot delegate that authority to the governor. The Legislative Budget and Audit Committee does play an oversight role by accepting the governor's proposed RPLs for review and can authorize them for spending within 45 days, but even the LBNA cannot stand in the place of the full legislature. And Mr. Chair, if LBNA does not recommend the RPLs proceed, the governor can go ahead and unilaterally decide to proceed with the spending. And some examples of concerns with the current process, I noticed that it would not matter if the money would still be available for appropriation when the legislature gets back into regular session, when the legislature could still appropriate the funds. It does not appear to matter if funding is available for use over several years, which we experienced with CARES fundings and ARPA funds, which had had deadline multiple years in the future that the legislature could still spend it. So the governor, under the current process, could arguably spend all the funds before the legislature even gets back into session. It wouldn't matter if the funds could still be available for revenue replacement, which we also know from the American Recovery, the American Recovery Act, that the funds were available for revenue replacement. And then if the governor's actions under the current RPL process are constitutional, then he would presumably be able to use that process even during the regular session when the legislature is in session, and the legislature in that sense could avoid its authority and its duty under the Constitution. Mr. Chair, SB 221 proposes fixes that would enable the legislature to provide for specific maximum increases to budget items in an appropriations bill for federal funds that exceed those forecasted. The governor can then propose RPLs to LBNA for review and confirmation that the proposed spending does not exceed the limit set by the legislature in an enacted appropriations bill. And the process may also be iterative, with LBNA proposing different funding levels or distributions among multiple items addressed by the full legislature in an enacted appropriations bill. Mr. Chair, we think this bill provides a good fix to the problem that apparently results from the current process that appears to be unconstitutional. And if the members have any questions for me, I would entertain them. Otherwise, I could proceed with the sectional analysis.
We'll stop for the moment because there's a lot at play here. So does any member have a question or comment yet? Okay, then please proceed with the sectional. And if you just mention the fiscal note at the end, too, that'd be great.
Okay, sectional analysis for SB 221, proposed CS version I in the Senate State Affairs Committee. Section 1 provides an express exception to allow the governor to call a special session in less than 30 days to address appropriations of additional federal receipts in excess of those accounted for under the amendments of this legislation. Section 2 amends the revised program legislative process to provide that for the state to expend additional funds it receives above the appropriations made in an appropriations bill, the funds may only be federal funds and may only be spent in accordance with the following procedure. In an appropriations bill, the legislature may provide for an amount that is a specific maximum increase of an appropriation item above the amount actually appropriated by an appropriations bill. The specific maximum increase may be provided as a percentage of an appropriation item. And one, the governor may submit a proposal for spending the additional federal funds via a, quote, revised program to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee for review. Two, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee reviews the governor's revised program proposal and may recommend alternative funding amounts or distributions among multiple items, not to exceed any specific maximum increases previously provided by an appropriation bill. Three, the governor may submit a corrected or changed revised program proposal to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee for review. Four, once the governor submits a final revised program proposal, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee confirms the proposal does not exceed any specific maximum increases previously provided by an appropriation bill. And five, the revised program amounts confirmed by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee may be expended after 45 days unless the committee recommends an earlier date of the expenditures. Section 3, to expend amounts exceeding those permissible under the RPL process, including applying funds to other items not previously addressed with a specific maximum increase in an appropriations bill, the governor must call a special session. Section 4, this section establishes that the new RPL process would not apply to items funded under the previous RPL provisions as they read and were applicable before the effective date of the act. That concludes the sectional analysis.
Thank you. And do you have any comments on the fiscal note?
I don't believe there was a fiscal note, Jim.
That's right. I just want to put it out there for the record. So I usually like to mention if there is one and discuss it, and if not, just so people understand the bill actually doesn't have one attached to it. I'd like to hear from the sponsor. Is that it? Something coming up on that one? Okay. That being said, questions or comments at this time from committee members? Senator Ramble?
This will be quick in two sections of the bill. It's Section 1 and Section 4. It basically, the governor's got to call a special session. We both were writing a note. We hope it's not in Juneau. I mean, if there's anything we can do for having an on-the-road system, for goodness sake, we spend a lot of time here. And I know that might be a little amendment that comes up.
Senator Filikowski, you have any comments?
I don't have any comments.
Okay, well, thank you.
If there's an amendment.
Senator Costello, I'm sorry, I thought it was no hand at this time. Okay. I do want to bring this up because you and I discussed this earlier today on this. We do have a member of, I think just one member of LBNA that obviously sees this. And I remember from 2 years ago going through this and the whole battle that we're still setting ourselves up for again. And I had asked you earlier today, had you seen the Senate Bill 241, which is the governor's request, which I believe was drafted in December, which is all of the money coming in and we don't have the final rules for it yet. And I was kind of going, well, huh, that's interesting. So I'm asking other senators, have you seen this? Nobody else had either. So here we go again with having no bite at the apple, no chance to look at where the money goes. I don't know what's important in your district. I imagine you don't know what's important in mine. I would think it would be important for us to have a chance to look at this have the ability to have input on this kind of money coming to the state. Whether it's $1 million or $1 billion is almost irrelevant. It's the process. That's what we talked about. This process should be have the appropriate input, and it should follow the constitutional rules, which you pointed out that it clearly probably does not, even though I'm not a lawyer. So I'm a bit upset at the moment that feel like we're going through this process again and we're being taken out of the loop and the ability to have our input as the legislative body, and not just between the executive and legislative branches, but even inside the legislative branch, when a few people on the finance committee are going to have a chance to look at this and not the rest of us, because that's not the way this is supposed to work, in my opinion. So this is after the subcommittee process, by the way. It's all closed out. And now here we go, and we're going to hand another $1 billion almost to the Senate, Finance Committee co-chairs to come up with a plan and the governor. And I'm going, where are we in the process? So I appreciate this, Senator Wilkowski, because I think there's a much broader thing at play here. And once again, I feel like I'm just completely left out of the process as is my district and what matters to me and my people, which would apply to everybody here, including you. So that's more of a comment, but that's this battle is unfolding as we go, obviously, with this one. But I see where it's going already, and it's kind of a normal MO, and it's very frustrating to feel like we don't have that chance to have that input. So this should be, one, we should follow the Constitution. Two, we should change it to make sure it's right. And three, every legislator sitting in this building ought to have a chance to have input into this, and we clearly have not. So I, for one, as well, especially after what happened before, really appreciate the fact that you're bringing this up, and we're going to do our best to move this along so we can hopefully get it to the next committee. I would also talk about, we went through one on page 2, section 2, on line 8, where we went through this when some of us were in a different town under a special call before, and we were rolled. So that's something that we may want to take up as well, but that's something we can certainly discuss. So that being said, any other questions, comments from committee members this time, Senator Costello?
Yeah, I do just want to make a comment about what I believe is fundamentally wrong with handing off the constitutional authority of the legislature, our power of appropriation, to a committee when we're not in session. And so I really appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I think I hope that it sees the light of day, and I think it will resolve a lot of the conflict that we have with the RPL process. The fact that as an elected official, certain members aren't permitted to participate in that process simply because the legislature is not in session, and yet there's all sorts of avenues to call ourselves in the special session, but just because we're not meeting, we defer to this committee. So I see this as a bill that's really fixing a fundamental problem with the process as we have it now.
Just on that point, Mr. Chair, I think the what's even, I guess, more shocking is even that committee that we defer the power to doesn't have the chance to stop it. The governor could issue a finding and say, we think this is not any, we don't think this should be appropriated, and the governor can simply ignore that, which is kind of shocking.
Senator Costello, follow up.
Thank you. And, you know, your sponsor statement does a good job of outlining that. I think, you know, the balance of power is very important in this, you know, our government. And I think that this process that we have really undermines the power of the legislature. The fact that we're not in session, you know, we're in session for a short period of time. We're already, you know, fighting, you know, two other branches of government that are, you know, in operation full time. And I don't see any problem with having the legislature coming back and dealing with this, you know, these types of issues. And so I, you know, I'm very much in support of getting rid of that process.
Thanks. And I see a couple of possible changes in here. Like I talked about, we'll discuss those, but there's some things here that could definitely clean that up for how personally I've experienced things take place here. But I will still go back to this and say, I'll say it one more time. I think that an important part of this process is individual legislators should have input into this. This shouldn't be run by just the governor. Shouldn't be run by just a handful of legislators. We all should have a bite of this apple, so-called, because it's our districts. Nobody knows what we need better than our people, or our people need better than we do. That's part of why we're here. And I continually, with this, feel like a mushroom left in the dark, fed a bunch of you-know-what that I don't have a chance to have input into this process. It's ridiculous, and we can do better than that. So I'm hoping that, like I said, this will see the light of day. It's probably appropriate with my mushroom comment. Senator Ramble?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You should be happy that you're getting us all wound up, and it's 5 o'clock, and we've been in here for 9 hours listening to people, basically, because this is an incredibly important issue. And I just want to say I echo the comments of both of the members that just spoke, because I have been so frustrated watching Legislature Office since a freshman. I've been trying to watch that committee. And this RPL process, I find, could be completely unacceptable, and that's why I just want to say thank you, and I really hope this bill makes it to the finish line soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ramble. Other comments or questions? Okay, so Senator Filikowski, any wrap up for today?
I am glad to see so much interest in the bill.
I wish we would have had a little sooner.
I guess just one suggestion, and I know the committee will do what the committee will do. As we move forward, I know there's interest in maybe other areas, and I might agree or not agree with those areas, but this is dealing with RPLs and the process, and I think the more that's added to it may make it more difficult to get through the rest of the body. So that's my only suggestion, Mr. Chairman.
Understood, and of course, anybody that has amendments, they can work with your office and see where we stand on that and discuss that as a committee as well. I would ask, based on that comment, if you have amendments to this, including we should address the title change, I think we could probably do that and get it taken care of. Please get those to my office by this Friday, the close of business, the 8th of April, and we'll plan on trying to get the bill back up next week and go through those and get this moved, because I do think this is a very important one for every legislator. They ought to do that. I would like to, while we have you here, is go ahead and get the public testimony taken care of. So we're going to do that real quick, and then we'll be out of time. So we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony on Senate Bill 221. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing and hearing none, I do not see anybody online. We'll validate. So at this time, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony on Senate Bill 221. That being said, I've talked about amendments, and we'll set it aside, and we will see you guys as soon as we can. Thank you very much for coming in today. And I had hoped to get to Senate Bill 194, but sometimes that's the way it goes. We're basically out of time, so we're going to go ahead and try to move that to the next day of business, this Thursday, and I'll work with Senator Kawasaki's office on that. My apologies, this just happens. So that's going to conclude our business for today. Senate State Affairs will meet again this Thursday, April 7th, 2022 at 3:30 p.m. back in this room. Seeing no other business before the committee, will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:59.